Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hi, this is Mark Snow, composer for The X-Files, and you are listening to the fabulous X-Cast.
Welcome back, everyone, to the X-Cast. The truth is in here. I'm Tony Black, your host, and this episode we are covering the 12th episode of the second season of The X-Files, Aubrey. And I'm delighted to be joined once again for his first full appearance on the X-Cast to do an episode, but his second appearance in reality, Brandon Shaymatala. Welcome back, sir.
Someone's got to take the blame, little brother, and it's not going to be me.
Excellent. I love that line. That's a great line. have you been since our interview with Mark Snow a couple of months ago?
Absolutely fantastic.
How's Melodic Treks going, your Star Trek podcast?
I've been having a lot of fun with it. There's been a lot of great stuff that's been happening, and I am eager to continue on with it and keep moving along with my music.
It's a great show, and I hope you guys have gone and checked it out since we talked about it after Mark's interview with us. Because it's even if you're not a Star Trek fan, to be honest, there's a lot to enjoy there. And if you are a Star Trek fan, go and check it out if you haven't already, because it is great. And Brandon's been kind enough to come on to talk Aubrey. But before we do, we're going to do the usual thing. And even though Brandon has technically been on before, he hasn't been on for the full traditional episode. So we're going to do the five questions of X with Brandon to gauge your fandom. And let's kick it off by asking you, to begin with, when did you first discover The X-Files?
I remember watching the teasers for the show coming in the fall on Fox, and it really intrigued me. And I didn't watch the pilot when it aired, but I did catch a couple of first season episodes, and I think Squeeze was the first one that I actually watched live. But I do remember that what hooked me and what got me into The X-Files and made me come back was during the summer repeat before season two of the Erlenmeyer Flask. And watching that episode, I'm like, I'm done. I am watching this show every week from now on.
Yeah, I'm not surprised that's the one that hooked you in, really. Mm-hmm. It is a classic, yeah. So you were there fairly early on then.
Yeah.
With it. Yeah, that's great. That's really good that you were there from the very beginning. So you mentioned Squeeze. What would your favorite episode be? Would it be Squeeze, or did you...
Definitely not. I mean, there's so many great episodes of The X-Files. It's so hard to choose. And, you know, I think it's a tie. And I'm known on the network where I'm from, with the Star Trek Network, as having odd tastes. So I'm not sure how odd these choices are or not. But I would have to say, for a favorite episode, it is a tie. And I can't quite choose between Drive and Via Negativa.
Oh, that's great, because we very rarely get episodes from later in the show's run said on when I asked this question. And Drive's, yeah. I love both of those. Drive obviously is the one with Bryan Cranston as the guy who makes Mulder drive him across country, because he's kind of been infected by what seems to be like an army transmission. And then Via Negativa is really, it's a great Doggett story, isn't it, from season 8,
which it's so spooky. And like both of those have such creepy parts in them, which is what I like. Like the Star Trek episodes that are my favorites are generally creepy ones and dark ones. And you know, in Drive, that scene when they're all dressed up in those containment suits and stuff, and they go into that place and they're going around with flashlights and they come across that deaf woman. Like that's that, oh man, that scares the pants off me every time I see it. And in Via Negativa, it's just so dark and moody, and you're like, what is going on here? It's such a ludicrous concept, like this cult leader with this third eye. It's like, this is dumb. But you know, when you watch the episode, it's just so dark and moody, and it's a dream. And I don't know, it really works for me, and I really love that episode.
It's that last scene with Doggett with the axe that gets me in that one, where he's possessed by yeah. the guy, and he's walking to, I think it's Scully he's walking towards with the axe, and he knows that he's got an axe, and he's going to, oh, it's just amazing. It's a brilliantly shot, because it's just, the light keeps fading in and out. It's amazing. Yeah, I'm a big fan of both of those, so I think those are great choices, actually. Obviously, those are from season 6 and season 8. Would you say either one of those is your favorite season then? Or
overall? No, definitely not. I think I might surprise you on this one too. Season 1.
Really?
I really love how the show started. And a part of it is really because of Mark Snow's music, you know? And we kind of talked about it in the interview. It really has that retro 70s and 80s horror movie feel to the music. And I love how there's so many, you know, Monster of the Week episodes. They're getting their footing. They don't quite know what to do. And there are a lot of gems in there. Now, I haven't listened to your entire back catalog. And I know from talking to my friend Zach Moore that you guys weren't a fan of Shapes. But, I mean, I really love Shapes. And that is one of my favorite episodes of The X-Files. But Darkness Falls is another one of my favorite episodes that I really love. You know, Conduit, I think, is absolutely fantastic. EBE, like, there's some treasures in season one.
Yeah, there are, to be fair. I mean, you know, when we've picked through season one previously, we've found it in general to be a middling season in places. And, you know, it's still finding its feet. It's still experimenting in many ways. But that's part of the charm. You know, it isn't by any stretch of the imagination the worst season of the show. And there are some genuine, like you mentioned, there are some genuine gems. Darkness Falls is a great episode. EBE is really good, yeah. Conduit has some great moments. And the music is terrific. You know, it is terrific. So I think it's great to hear some love for season one, because it doesn't get much. So, and it's got probably the best season finale of all of them, or one of the best season finales of all of them. So it's not a bad season. So that's great, Brendan. Yeah. Who would you say your favourite character then is? That's my fourth question. And this doesn't have to be Mulder or Scully. It can be anyone in the show, even a guest character if you wanted.
Mr. X.
Somebody said Mr. X. Who was it who said Mr. X? I don't know. Somebody else has said Mr. X. Yeah, good choice. Yeah. Why?
Oh, because I like the idea of the government informant. And what I like about Mr. X is he's like, I do not want to be here. I do not want to be doing this. I am doing this against my will, but here's this file. And, you know, I was really sad when he died at the end of season 4. It was the end of season 3, the start of season 4, I think it was when he
start
died.
Of season 4.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah. And he was just such a cool character. You know, and he's got a great voice, and I don't know, I love Mr. X. I think he's great.
He is great. Really well played by Stephen Williams as well. He's a really, really cool character, and I think it's because he's not in a massive amount of it, you know, and the characters like that who don't appear forever are very fondly remembered. So, yeah, really good choice, really good choice. Finally then, we've talked about your different episodes, seasons, things like that. What would your favourite moment from the show be? If you had to pick one scene or moment that stood out.
Again, this has got to be a tie, and it's so hard to choose, but it's when Deep Throat gets shot in the Erlenmeyer flask, because like right then and there, like it completely hooked me into the X-Files when that happened. And the other one that it's a tie is when they throw the bomb into the train car in Anasazi. Like, what a cliffhanger that is. Like, those, Anasazi is like one of the greatest cliffhangers of all time.
Burn it!
So oh man, that hooked me. Like that those two episodes ruined my summer, that's for sure.
That was an amazing cliffhanger. The first real heart in mouth season ending cliffhanger the show ever did. Those are great choices. The moment where myself and Andrew Brooker talked about this in the Erlenmeyer flask episode, but the moment where, you know, he gets Deep Throat gets shot, I mean it's a complete oh my god moment. Yeah. It still resonates, you know, even to the point that my sign off every week with the X-Cast is Deep Throat's dying words, and they are the mantra, one of the two mantras of the show. So yeah, great choices. That's the five questions of X. Let's talk about the episode we're here to discuss today. Let's go on to talk Aubrey. Aubrey, then, is the 12th episode of the second season of The X-Files. It first aired on January the 6th, 1995, so it was the first episode back after the Christmas break. and it was written by Sara B. Charno and directed by Rob Bowman. The story sees Mulder and Scully arriving in Aubrey, Missouri, after the mysterious unearthing of bones that appear to be of an FBI agent who mysteriously vanished over 50 years ago and now may be connected to an old killer and a detective who is experiencing strange flashbacks.
Special Agent Sam Chaney.
That name sounds familiar. Yeah.
Chaney's a legend. 40 years before the Bureau started profiling violent criminals, Chaney and his partner Tim Ledbetter would work on their own time investigating what were then called stranger killings, what are now called serial murders. They disappeared while investigating three murders in Aubrey, Missouri in 1942. Chaney's body wasn't found until 2 days ago by a local detective, B.J. Morrow, a woman.
What's your interest in this case?
During their time, Chaney's and Ledbetter's ideas weren't very well received by their peers. Using psychology to solve a crime was something like,
believing in the paranormal?
Exactly. But there's another mystery.
Which is?
Well, I'd like to know why this policewoman would suddenly drive her car into a field the size of Rhode Island and for no rhyme or reason dig up the bones of a man who's been missing for 50 years. I mean, unless there was a neon sign saying, dig here.
I guess that's why we're going to Aubrey.
Yes, and also I've always been intrigued by women named BJ.
That's me being fairly cryptic with my description of Aubrey, but that's because it's one of those X-Files that doesn't quite tip its hand straight away. So, for that reason, Brandon, if you had to rate it out of 10, what would you go for with Aubrey?
I'm glad that I watched it twice in preparation for this. I watched it on Friday night, and then I watched it again this morning right before we recorded here. And going back and watching it, it was the first episode of The X-Files that I've seen in quite a while. And I really enjoyed it on my first watching. And I probably would have given it an 8.5 out of 10 or an 8 out of 10 on it, because it was like, it's still a really, really good episode. But, you know, I'd probably drop it down a little bit right now to probably I'd give it a 7.5 or an 8 out of 10. Not a lot of a drop, but drop it a little bit, I think.
Why would you put it around? Because that's fairly high, you know, 7.5, 8. Why would you put it around that area?
There are some absolute awesome moments in this episode with camera movements, with the music, you know, with kind of chilling things that happen and stuff that throws you off, because a lot of the times in the episode, it does leave you guessing, right? Mm. And I hadn't seen this episode in quite a while, so watching it again the first time there on Friday night, I was guessing. But, I mean, that first scene, the teaser, right, when Mark Snow's drums are just going crazy,
yeah,
when she's digging up those bones, right? And the camera and the look on her face, like the woman that played B.J. Morrow did a really great job with her face, and I think she's a really great actress. But when
Deborah Strang, her name is.
Deborah Strang. So the camera is like on her face and she's looking all weird to the side and stuff, and then the camera pulls around her and like above her, you know? So it's this weird moody effect that's going on. And right after the teaser, when he come back and Mulder's talking to her and he asks her, have you ever had any precognition or anything like that? Like the look on her face. So she really brings it up a notch for me. I think she does a really good job in this episode. And that's what one of the joys of this episode is.
It's one of those episodes that's not at all about Mulder and Scully. And it's very much about the guest characters. You know, it's one of those traditional standalone episodes. And some of those in The X-Files fall down when they don't have strong characters played by the right actors. And I think Aubrey is one of those episodes that absolutely does. She is really great as B.J. Morrow.
And Terry O'Quinn as well. I mean, you know, the acting that he does in this episode, when she gives him that note and says, I'm pregnant, right? And they talk about it and whatnot. And he's going to go back and talk to the coroner on the phone. And he just takes that moment to, like, you know, kind of sigh and lean his head forward and stuff. Like, that's just an interesting little beat that he added. And I think it adds a lot to the episode and the characters.
Yeah, absolutely. I might as well get this out of the way here. Terry O'Quinn is my favourite actor of all time, okay? I absolutely love everything that man does. He never, ever, ever puts a foot wrong for me. So this is one of three appearances he makes in... four appearances he makes in the Carterverse, or the 1013-verse, to the point that he actually got the nickname Mr. 1013, because he actually appeared, obviously, here as Brian Tillman, who's the detective in the case. He appears in the X-Files movie, Fight the Future, as Darius Michaud, who is an FBI special agent in charge who he has quite a nasty death. He appears in a major role in Millennium as Peter Watts, who's one of the major recurring characters, and it's an amazing character, brilliant performance. He makes that partly one of the reasons that show's so great.
Mm-hmm.
And he also appears in Harsh Realm, which is the lesser-known fourth series from Chris Carter that only lasted a few episodes, but he plays General Santiago in that. It's a really interesting show. And, you know, we may cover that a little bit on the X-Cast because we're going to do a lot of the 1013 stuff, so we may do some Harsh Realm.
See, I remember him. Did you ever see a show called Earth 2?
Yes. Yeah.
I remembered him from that. So when I saw him on the X-Files for the first time, I'm like, oh, that's that guy from Earth 2. You know, so I thought that was kind of funny.
He's been in loads of things. You know, he was in Alias. He played an amazing character in season 2 of Alias, season 1 and 3 a little bit as well. And I loved him in that. Played assistant director Kendall in that. He was great. He obviously then went on to appear in Lost, which is probably his biggest ever role as John Locke, which was, whether you love Lost or not, I think many people would agree that Terry O'Quinn was great in that as Locke, really. So, you know, he's just great. He's gone on to do other stuff since, but those are his main. And he memorably cropped up in Star Trek as well, in The Pegasus,
yep,
which is my favourite episode of The Next Generation as well, partly because of Terry. But also, I really think it's a great story. But yeah, he's just brilliant. He's one of those actors who is always, always great. And he often takes material and punches it up. So he's another reason why, as Brian Tillman in this episode works so well.
So I'm looking on IMDb this morning here, looking up some stuff, getting ready for the episode, and it does give him another X-Files credit with an episode from season 9 called Trust No One. They call him the Shadow Man.
Absolutely. I forgot about this. Yes, he appears 3 times. Good memory. Yeah. He's a super soldier in that episode in the end.
Mm-hmm.
I
can't take credit for that. I saw it on IMDb this morning, so I don't remember that part. It's been a while since I've seen season 9, so.
No, you're right. Trust No One isn't a bad episode. It's one of the better episodes of season 9, and he's the Shadow Man. He turns out to be an alien super soldier, mm-hmm, who is hunting Mulder when Mulder's off screen and he's, you know, on the lam and things like that, and he ends up confronting Scully. And yeah, I completely forgot about that. I love this. I really want to create sort of an idea that all of these characters are related that Terry O'Quinn is playing. I want there to have been some sort of cloning project that created Peter Watts. And
so Shadow Man is the smoke monster?
Yeah. They're all linked. They're all linked in the Terry O'Quinn verse. But yeah, I had to get that out of the way. And people who know me well enough, my friends, know my absolute adoration for Terry O'Quinn and how I think if I ever met him, I would just end it there because my life would be complete. So it's just got a great cast. I'm going to agree with you on Aubrey. I think it's a 7.5 shading an 8. I agree completely. And it was one of those episodes that I remember when I was younger. Some episodes in the X-Files do fade from memory, but Aubrey's always stuck in my head because of the visuals and because of a lot of the stuff. But it's actually got some, and we'll get into this, but it's got some really interesting themes and ideas in Sarah Beechano's script, which are quite fascinating, actually, about memory and about childhood and about all sorts of things. And it's got a lot under the skin, that makes it a really, really...
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Interesting thematic story, as well as being quite a scary X-File as well. Mm-hmm. So... yeah, I'm quite a fan of this, and I would say it's up there with some of the better ones in season 2, actually. Because it's interesting that Chano originally developed the story that revolved around 50-year-old murders and the transfer of genetic memory as a separate thing. And then it was later combined with a separate concept about a female serial killer, which they were thinking of. So it's interesting. And then Morgan and Wong, Glenn Morgan and James Wong, contributed some extra scenes in the story. So it's got a lot of good people pitching into the pot with this. So I think it all comes together very well.
Yeah, I would agree. Absolutely, yeah.
On IMDb, it's got an average rating of 7.7 out of 10.
Yeah, see, we're pretty close there.
Yeah. That's an aggregate rating, though, of like 2,188 votes. And all IMDb ratings tend to rank from around 9.2 or 3 down to about 6.5. So they're never really above or under that. But that places Aubrey in a decent place, really. And I think that's a good average. IMDb always doesn't get it right, really, but I would say that's quite fair. So let's jump in and talk about it in more detail. So you've mentioned a little bit about the teaser, Brandon, already. And I think it's you can tell this is a Rob Bowman episode, because Rob Bowman already, and we've yet to see Kim Manners direct an episode. That's coming very soon. And Kim Manners was one of the three greatest X-Files directors, and I've mentioned this before. But Rob Bowman is one of them. And obviously he goes on to direct the movie, and he made a real stamp with episodes like Gender Bender in the past. And you know, he whenever he directs an episode, you can tell. And so I think when you talked about how it sets a visual tone straight away, I think you're absolutely right there.
Yeah, he's done a lot of great episodes of, you know, Next Generation and stuff as well.
Yeah, he's done a fair few shows back in the day, didn't he?
Yeah.
And he always creates a very visual stamp. You know, and even to things like, you know, the tracking shot when we first get into the episode and we're in the Aubrey detective, you know, department, and he's following Terry O'Quinn as they're discussing, you know, these murders and things like that. And then you see BJ, who is the, you know, and you immediately see, you know, the camera just pushes towards her. It's just immediate sense of that he's got ideas with the camera.
And he shows a connection between them without any words. Like, just the way that he's filmed it and the way that he's shot it, you know that there's a connection between these two people right off the bat.
Absolutely, which then is backed up when we get into the office of Tillman, and you immediately got the picture of him with his wife.
Yeah.
At which point we then find out that they're having an affair, and there's a sense of tension around Tillman. You know, even that buzzer that goes off, it's just... And then she writes, "I'm pregnant," on a piece of paper. Mm-hmm. It's a very good way, through minimal dialogue and visuals, to establish that these two are co-workers, but they're also deeper involved. And there's also a bit of a disparity in that you immediately get the sense that BJ wants more from their relationship. She's talking about making him dinner and things like that. And he just wants to meet her in a motel at like 10 p.m. and mm-hmm. discuss this. And mm-hmm. she's like, "Oh, motel? Really?" So they're not quite on the same page, are they?
No, absolutely. You can tell that she wants more. But I mean, relationships, like affairs, are portrayed that way in television a lot, you know, where, you know, the woman, like, we come to it later on, and it's a weird line going back to it where Scully's like, "Oh, they're having an affair. How do you know?" "A woman senses these things." And it's like, you know, so it's kind of portrayed that way, that the women usually want more out of the affair than the man does. And they're, I think that this episode falls into that cliche for sure. Like, I'm sure had we stuck with these characters over a couple of weeks, at some point we would get out the line, "So when are you leaving your wife?"
Absolutely. There's some interesting stuff with Scully and the way she reacts to some of this, which we'll get into later, because it is interesting. Obviously, you've set up this relationship with these two, and then you've got BJ starting to go through what ends up transforming her throughout the episode, which is the immediate sort of very atmospheric, creepy flashbacks that Rob Bowman shows us of the, you know, the murder 50 years ago of Sam Chaney, who's the FBI agent. And the note I made about music, I couldn't agree more with you when you mentioned it earlier. The way Mark Snow builds up that scene with music where BJ is scrabbling in the dirt and you've got the flashes of the cop beat of the FBI agent being buried, it's amazing. And it just brings you to this edge of, "Oh my God, what's going on?" This panic.
Those drums, like, he just goes crazy, you know, like with these drums and this music, and it's awesome. You know, it fits because, like, it portrays the confusion that she's going through at that time, you know, like she can't get a thought properly, like she doesn't know what's going on clearly either, right?
That complete sense of what am I doing here? What is going on? Why am I scrabbling in the dirt? Why have I uncovered a body? You know, the bones of a body. It's terrifying. It's one of those terrifying things you get in the X-Files that happens to people that, you know, if you look at it and you would think, "Jesus, how would I feel if that happened to me, that I woke up suddenly and I had a flashback and suddenly I'm uncovering a body?" I mean, it's a scary idea that they do really well. It's a really good teaser. And it's, You know, it's a longer teaser than some of the ones we've had before, but it's a very good one. But then when we get out of the teaser and we're into the main chunk of the episode, we've got Scully, in a nice way, being shown from a scientific point of view the teeth of Sam Chaney. And he's... Now, this is a great... I love it when The X-Files does actually go back into the history books and pulls out certain things about the FBI historically. And I'd forgotten about the legend of Sam Chaney, who was basically like an early Mulder, wasn't he, in many respects?
Yeah, because he tried to do these psychological profiling of people and stuff like this, and back in the 40s, they wouldn't have it, right?
No, absolutely. They were called stranger killings back then, weren't they? What were serial killings known by the time Mulder would have got into the violent crime section and he was, you know, doing that kind of thing?
I love that name, Stranger Killings. That's like, that's so neat, you know?
Be a good name for a show, wouldn't it? Like a like an investigation show. The Stranger Killings. Yeah, it was the idea that Sam Chaney was quite ahead of his time, really, in terms of, you know, what he was doing and the way he was looking at cases. I kept thinking, actually, all the way through, that he was maybe a little bit more like a Frank Black template from Millennium than Mulder.
Okay.
And I don't think it would have taken, I don't know about you, but I don't think it would have taken much tweaking for this to be a Millennium episode.
Yeah, oh, 100%, you're totally into that.
Because this seems, it almost seems like at this point when they were making the X-Files, obviously Millennium is about a year and a half away. It was mm-hmm. the start of X-Files season 4 when Millennium premiered. Mm-hmm. But you get the feeling with episodes like this, and Irresistible is the next episode, which is the most millenniumistic episode the X-Files did up until that show. You get the feeling that Chris Carter is really starting to think about that idea more, and there's quite a few episodes in season 2 that you could have as millennium episodes. Mm-hmm. So when I look back, I find that really interesting as well.
Yeah, because she's kind of got the same ability as him at first, right, until you find out what's going on at the end, where she's, you know, I get these flashes and this is what happened, and that's basically what Frank Black had.
Totally. It's just obviously Frank was able to, you know, not kill because of it. Right. Although it's that idea that it could have sent it. And Hannibal, actually, the most recently, plays more with the idea of whether or not, with the character of Will Graham, mm-hmm. whether or not these kind of, you know, complete sort of psychosis, you know, flashes of what a murderer can do could actually make you a killer. And they do go a lot more into the psychology of that than Millennium, in a way, does. Millennium is more about how that, what Frank's gift or curse is in relation to the mystical elements of the Millennium Group and things like that. But it is interesting. And I think that what it's saying here is great. Mulder comes out with a cracking one-liner as well at the end of this scene, doesn't he, with Scully? Can you remember?
I've always been fascinated by women named BJ. That's a great Mulder line.
It is a great Mulder line. And I would argue, and this is taking nothing away from Sara Buciano, but I think that's a Morgan and Wong line, because Morgan and Wong are great at this, and they know exactly where to put a Mulder like one-liner. So if I had to guess, I think that's them. I do wonder, in fact, that if they came up with the character called BJ just so they could make him do that line.
It's so funny, you know, like watching this when I was, you know, 14 years old or whatever, like I never caught the joke, right?
You know, so. You'd be like, what does he mean?
I guess that is a weird name for a woman.
This idea of an unsolved murder, and, you know, these FBI agents who were missing, Chaney and his partner were missing for years. They come into it, Mulder and Scully, from the angle of, this isn't a present day murder, this is a historical murder that BJ has uncovered in some strange way. Mulder is there saying, well, how did BJ know where to look? You know, he said, unless there was a neon sign saying, dig here. That's unusual. They normally don't come into a case based on a historical murder, mm-hmm. as opposed to a new murder, which we do eventually get. But that's a nice way of coming into it as well. And obviously, this is the point where, as you mentioned, they question BJ, and they're trying to figure out how she knew, and she is confused herself. And you get Tillman trying to leap to her defense, especially when Mulder brings up clairvoyance, which is the classic Mulder moment, isn't it, where he goes to the, so have you had any experiences with psychic visions?
Yes.
And Tillman's like, what?
Yeah, that's enough of that.
It's that whole thing, isn't it, that BJ could well have told him there and then, I'm having these weird flashbacks, but there's always an official detective or sheriff or somebody basically saying to Mulder, don't be silly, what are you doing? You know, this isn't your case, go away. Something like that. But it's right. Got a more of an emotional component, hasn't it? Because of the connection between Tillman and BJ. He's not just an obstructive sheriff.
He's protective.
Yeah, exactly. He's like a protective, not quite husband, sort of lover, you know, would-be father and it gets into the whole themes of parenthood and children in this episode, which we'll get into, and it's, you know, it all touches on that. The other thing in terms of the music as well, Brendan, I don't know if you noticed, there's a really creepy little weird sort of theme going through this as well. I don't know whether it's a flute, but it's a little motif, and I don't know if you picked up on it, but it's sort of when there's a murder about to happen. Do you know what I mean by that?
I didn't catch it on my rewatch here.
You'd know it if you heard it, I think. But it's quite unique to Aubrey, and I think that's something that comes in. I think it's when Mulder and Scully are looking at Chaney's bones as well, and Mulder reads Chaney's diary and things like that. But these are all moments where you're starting to get the pieces put together, aren't you? Like sister or brother being etched into the chest, which is horrible, isn't it?
When I first got into this episode and rewatching it, I kind of got confused for a minute, because again, it's been a while since I've seen some of the season 2 episodes, but I thought for a second that it was the one where they had the black felt on their backs, because I knew there was something written on the bodies in this episode.
Red Museum? He is one, she is one.
And I knew that there was the gender issue as well. So going into the episode, I thought it was that, and thinking, you know, back in the day, and this would have been creepy if they carved it into their chest. And then all of a sudden we see this carved in the chest. I'm like, oh, I must be thinking of something else. And then I realized after the fact which one it was that I was thinking of, right?
Yeah, you're right, yeah. Because Red Museum is only 3 episodes ago. So, yeah, they do this in similar succession, really, with words being, you know, written or etched on people's bodies. That whole, you know, you've got, what I like is that you've got, having the detective involved, BJ, be the one who it's happening to. When Mulder and Scully are looking into all the bones and they're trying to use computer programs to put everything up, BJ's there looking at it, knowing that something is wrong. And that just adds another extra dimension that you don't always get. Sometimes in a lot of these episodes, Mulder and Scully's investigations are, they're fine and they're batting theories around, but there's no weight to it. There's no emotional element to it. Mm-hmm. In this one, there is, because it's about BJ. And right. I think that adds something more to it. Like you mentioned, Scully's intuition. There is something... but there is an extra thing to this, and it's retroactive because they didn't know they were going to put this in later. But I don't know if you remember... I'm testing your memory here, Brandon. But sure. I don't know if you remember an episode called All Things in season 7.
No. Yeah, like I know the name. I know that it's there. But give me a word that'll help me remember here. Test my memory.
Buddhism.
No, not ringing a bell.
Okay. Well, in that episode, that one was directed by Gillian Anderson and written by her. And it's about Scully sort of finding a bit of New Age Buddhism. It's quite a semi-mystical, more of a character episode, really. Mulder's barely in it. It's the one where they sleep together, and you see that they've slept together anyway.
Okay.
In that, the reason I bring it up is because in that episode, you find out that Scully had an affair with a former mentor of hers who was married. Okay. And he's dying in this episode. And it's interesting that she mentions this intuition, and that, you know, a woman sometimes knows, you know, that she's having an affair. And because I was thinking, well, you've been the other woman, haven't you, Scully? Mm-hmm. You know, you've been the woman.
Is that the one where she gets the tattoo?
No, that's Never Again. Okay. In season 4, which is a great episode. The Jodie Foster talking tattoo on Rodney Rowland's arm. Yeah. But yeah, it's just interesting. Obviously, you know, production-wise, they didn't know Scully had that in her backstory. But those little things just actually connect up now, funnily enough, retroactively. So it just adds to the scene, really, that she can go to BJ and sort of have that sort of knowledge of being where she was, in a way, being the woman who's having an affair with a married man. I do like that.
Well, while we're on the scene, we got to talk about as well that computer program, that amazing computer program that can enlarge that rib cage and like get all that stuff out. Like, that is some epic technology there.
Well, don't they make a point of saying, oh, if Aubrey has this imaging technology, we can use it.
If this backwater town, you know, like, has this technology, we can totally use it to determine it. And now to enlarge the chest cavity to accommodate for gender difference.
Of course they can do that. Of course.
There's no small men, right? There's no small men, right? It's gender difference. So.
In 1995, in the middle of Missouri, of course they have that tech. Absolutely. Those things, you've got to just go... Okay, fine. Fine. Accept it, move on. But you know what made me laugh as well? After Scully goes and talks to BJ in the bathroom, and she senses that she's pregnant and all this, and they have that conversation, she then comes straight back out to Mulder and says, yeah, she's pregnant and she's having an affair.
Don't tell anybody.
Just keep it unto yourself, Scully. Yeah, sure, yeah, sure. Mulder, by the way, she's up the duff, and she's having an affair.
I was right.
And Mulder's just like, oh, okay. What do you want me to do with that, Scully? I'm like, no, where's the tact? That I've got to be honest, that seems a bit out of character. Because I don't think Scully would have done that.
I think she would have, because it adds to the case, and it gives Mulder more information that he needs to know for it, because they do know that something weird is going on here. So I buy that she tells him that.
Okay, that's another way of looking at it, to be fair, yeah. Yeah,
because they know that maybe there's something going on here.
Yeah, maybe in the context of the episode. Yeah, okay. I'll let her off.
But going,
let her off on
going back a half a second here, so one, there's another great character element in that scene that I think is just outstanding. When Scully goes in there to check on her, and she pulls down the paper towels to give to her, and then BJ Morrow just reaches past her to get paper towels because she doesn't want to take the paper towels from her because she doesn't want her charity. You know, like,
I didn't notice that. That's great.
It's a minor thing. I love Rob Bowman. Like, he adds these little character things in it. I don't know. Maybe it's not him. Maybe it's her, right? But there's some rich character development in this episode that really adds to what you're watching.
I didn't notice that. That's a good spot, Brandon. Little things like that. You're right. They just add that extra element. And it'd be interesting to know if it was Deborah Strang or it was Bowman's direction. Definitely. Either way, that's great. And that, it's after this that BJ basically makes the brother connection, doesn't she, from her, you know, her mind, and says, well, it says brother, so you've got brother and sister, depending on the sex of who, you know, was killed back in the day.
Which, honestly, is not that logical of a jump. Like, you got a dead woman and you got a dead man that you know is the FBI agent, and there's an R there. Like, it's, I don't know, you don't need a psychic anything to try and figure out that one.
Well, this the thing is, that's my only maybe thing with this episode, in that there are certain things that Mulder and Scully, especially Mulder, should guess that they don't really click with. I mean, Mulder should have really guessed BJ was probably doing this before Danny gives him that call and says, by the way, yeah, it's BJ's, what's his name's, granddaughter. It's like, and we'll get to this later, but I'm like, it's kind of obvious in a way. Mulder's obviously something not right with BJ.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey, you know, so there's a few moments in this where they should, and the brother thing is a good one, where they should go, right, so it's probably that then. And they don't. You can let it off for the purposes of plot, really.
And on a first watch, like, again, I caught these things on the second watch, right, when I watched it, you know, less than 2 days later, right? And when I hadn't seen it in years, you know, a lot of these things passed by me, and it I don't think it affects the plot in any way, right?
No, not at all. It doesn't bring it down necessarily. It's just, it's certain elements of the writing, I think. But it doesn't affect the plot, really. Mm-hmm. And this is the point where the plot really kicks off, because Tillman comes in thinking that the killings in 1942 are what's going on today, because they're the same. Mm-hmm. And he basically reveals there are new murders. There's a girl being killed. There's another one who just, you know, by pure coincidence, a guy suddenly turns up and goes, by the way, there's been another one.
Yeah.
Where did he come from? that's a bit fortuitous timing, which makes it more of a current threat now, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And it's great, too, the way that Terry O'Quinn reacts and is acting on that. And he's like, they're like, why do you have these files? Why do you have these pictures? No, they're old. No, they're not. Yes, they are. Oh, ooh. And he looks at it. And it's great, because it does bring it back to this, that it's a repetitive case, right?
Absolutely, yeah. I think, you know, and I know I'm very happy to sort of sing Terry O'Quinn's praises all the time, but I do think that he does a really good job, actually, with this character, because Tillman isn't the easiest character to play, because he's not very sympathetic in many ways, is he? Yeah. I mean, he, you know, he's got BJ pregnant because they've obviously not been careful. She's, without being too crude, she's not a young lady. You know, she's around 50. She's an old woman to be giving birth.
Okay, but no, she's not. So there's one of the weird timing aspects of it, right? Because as we get later on with Thibodeau, she says that her son, who's BJ's dad, would be about 50. So, like, the woman that they got to play BJ is a little bit too old for who she's supposed to be.
Of course, because it's not. She's not Thibodeau's daughter, is she? She's Thibodeau's granddaughter.
She's the granddaughter, right? So, in theory, she could be about 30, and I don't buy that she's 30.
No way. The actress must be about 40 at least.
Really. Yeah, so, I don't know, there's a little bit of timing off there, but...
Ah. Isn't that interesting, though, that they potentially chose an older-looking actress?
Yeah.
Because that must have been a conscious choice, because they could have, in theory, put a casting call out that said, okay, we're looking for someone between 25 and 30 to play a young detective. Yet they cast a woman who was...
Because the Linda Thibodeau attack took place in 1945, because the Stranger killings in Aubrey took place in 1942, and so when Linda Thibodeau goes and grabs the thing from behind the picture, she says he would be about 50 now. And rewatching the episode, I'm thinking, oh, this is where they get it wrong, and she's actually the daughter. But no, then they make a point that Linda Thibodeau, the son that she gave for adoption, is her dad.
And
she's the grandchild, right?
Absolutely, because it would have, for a while, I actually had the same thought in that I kept thinking, okay, well, BJ's Thibodeau's daughter, and then suddenly, it was like, oh, no, she's not. And it would have made more sense in terms of the actress if she'd have been the daughter than the grand. But the idea is that it skips a generation. That's the whole point of the genetic memory and things like that. But it's and unfortunately, I can't find out Deborah Strang's age, so I don't know.
Yeah, that's okay.
But it's curious. If anyone does know, that'd be interesting to find out a little bit more about this, because it is a key point, really. But as I say, Tillman isn't the most sympathetic of characters. You know, he wants her to get rid of the baby. You know, he wants his cake and eat it. He wants to have BJ. He wants her to get rid of the baby. You've got him being very dismissive at the same time, but also he is protective. He is trying to look out for her. And he is trying, so he plays it very well, because he has to be antagonistic necessarily, but then he also has to be caring, and it's a tough role to play, and he does it well. So that's what I'm talking about, the layers of this. And obviously, you know, now there's a girl who's been killed. It's at this point we get the idea that BJ's shocked because she dreamt about this woman dying, or she believes she dreamt about this woman. And this leads to what I think is probably the cheesiest moment in the episode, where after the act out, you've got the act opening with a little girl falling over in a park, and BJ just gets up and goes,
"Yeah, yeah." My kid falls down the stairs, and I'm like, "Be careful."
Yeah,
I'm exaggerating slightly, but
a little bit. And she's talking about how she's getting these feelings about motherhood, and it's like, okay, we get the idea, you know, you, it's about protection, it's about motherhood, but you don't have to whack us over the head with it like a mallet. It was a little bit much. It's a good conversation, because, you know, she's talking about how she's feeling about being a mother and about her dreams, and Mulder says something quite philosophical here. He says that he reckons dreams are answers to questions we've not figured out how to ask. What would you think about that, Brendan? Would you agree with dreams?
Sometimes a cigar is just a cigar.
That's what Scully should have said at that point, shouldn't she?
I don't know. I've had some weird dreams, you know, in my life, and, you know, whether it leads to deja vu or anything like that. But, you know, I've had some crazy dreams in my life, and I don't know if they're prophetic or what, but, yeah. I don't know. I think that your mind can definitely put things together. Like, for example, I used to work in retail, right? And I take my work very seriously, and whatever job I'm doing, I give it my all. And when it comes to Christmas time, I was working, you know, 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. because I was a commission-based salesman, right? And so any minute I'm off the floor is money out of my pocket in general, right, at the time. And I would come home, and I was working so much over Christmas that when I was sleeping, I was dreaming that I was working. So honestly, goodness, it felt like I worked for 30 days straight over Christmas.
Oh my God.
You know? Because I would work, and then I would dream that I would work. And it was like, it was just excruciating, right? So I don't know. I don't know if there's a connection or not, but that's just one of the things that I suffer with.
But it's interesting, isn't it? That, you know, that interpretation and the way the mind works. Yeah, that's a good example of that. And obviously the idea of dreams are wrapped up in the idea of memory with this, and that, you know, what BJ thinks are dreams are actually far more. And it's, you know, it is an interesting idea. And it's that whole, this is the point where she's starting to become more obsessed. And she's, you know, she's looking through all the 40s files, and Tillman doesn't really get it. And it's you know, they're having these conversations about, she's saying, I want to keep the baby and things like that. And he's going, well, hang on, this is our choice. It's not just your choice. So there's a real, almost a soap opera aspect to this episode, But it works, doesn't it? It doesn't feel like it's forced. It feels very natural and linked to the themes of the episode.
Well, it keeps the relationship between Tillman and BJ foremost on your mind throughout the episode, right?
Yeah, it keeps that at the forefront, doesn't it? It keeps that idea that, you know, we have to remember that BJ's pregnant. You know, she's not just going through this. She's pregnant with child, and that's key.
Right, it's key to the end of the episode for, like, what happened and why this happened, right?
Totally. It's important. And this is the connective that gets us to find out who Harry Coakley is. And Harry Coakley is... He's one of the... I think he stands out. I always remember him from the episode, played really well by Morgan Woodward, because he's a real human monster. You know, the X-Files doesn't have that many necessarily human monsters, but Harry Coakley's a really good one, isn't he? Because he's this young guy who, in the 40s, he killed and raped a woman or a few people, and he was put away for, like, most of his life, got out as an old guy, and now he's just this chain-smoking creep who lives in an old house... On a respirator, yeah, and he's just full of bitterness and anger and sarcasm, and he's really, I think he works really well in the context of this.
I'm sure that's the house from Shadows as well.
Yeah, it could be. It looked like the house from Home as well. It looked like it's not the same, but it looked like the Peacock's house from Home as well.
I'm sure in Vancouver they use those houses like more than once. So
yeah. I thought as well, I don't know if you thought this, I don't know if you noticed, but I thought the young Harry Coakley looked like a young Johnny Depp.
Sure.
It doesn't matter.
You squint just right at him, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, we find out the horrible backstory to Coakley, and Mulder, you know, puts it out there that maybe Coakley's started up killing again, and Scully's, you know, justifiably sceptical that he's able to do this at 77 years old. And she comes up with an interesting theory here called cryptonesia. Which is
consciously forgotten information.
Yeah, that's it. Consciously forgotten information, and that's an interesting idea, really. And it's an interesting scientific idea for what's going on. So that's a good Scully moment where she's able to put that out there. And that's the thing with this episode. It's not one of those episodes where the paranormality is too out there. It's more about the psychosis of the mind and about genetic connections and things like that. And it doesn't take too much for it to be able to put a scientific analysis into this, because it's one of those episodes that doesn't go too far off the deep end, which is good. It's great as well that Scully's just... There's a lot of... There's almost this, I think, this subconscious... Even if it is subconscious with Scully, this subconscious sort of anger in her about how men treat women in this. You know, and it comes out with Coakley when he starts calling the little sister.
Yeah, that's she's really creepy.
She's really creepy. And just his manner, he's a bit unrepentant, isn't he, about what he's done and who he is.
Yeah, that's a great line when he's calling her little sister, because, you know, instantly you think of these bodies with this sister carved on their chest, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, the fact that, you know, I love it, that line in the car that Mulder says where he's like, I don't want to jump out on a limb here, but this guy's our prime suspect, right?
Yeah.
Because how could these cops have not made this connection between the sister carved in the chest for all these other crimes and then this one, right? And
yeah.
They just gave you that information. So it's like, no, he didn't just kill one person. He killed a bunch of people and never got caught for all of them. And so when he's calling her that, like, you can see that it's affecting Scully a lot.
Yeah, because she knows. She knows it's kind of his way of going, yeah, I did it. You know, I'm the guy. I killed these people. I don't give a shit. I still, you know. And she knows. It's great when Scully faces people like this every now and then in the show. And her reaction and the way Gillian Anderson plays it is just that repulsion, isn't it? That kind of... Ugh, I know what you are, you know, and it's great when she does that. And I think she that's an underlying part of the underlying theme, really, about the whole episode. And then, you know, BJ, this is the point now where BJ really starts to lose it, and Rob Bowman does a great job as well with this, with the storms in when she's in bed at night and having the vivid flashes, seeing Coakley, young Coakley in the mirror, like a ghost, like a spectre. And then she's carved sister into a chest. Oh, yeah, that really scared me as a child. That really, really unsettled me. I always remember that.
It does, but that's one of the things that takes away on the rewatch. You're like, okay, so when you're watching it the first time and you forget the episode, or, you know, it's the first time you've seen the episode, you're like, wow, this is creepy. But then on the rewatch, the second time, you're like, so why does she carve it into her own chest? So,
well, is it the idea that because... So this is the thing. She's not possessed by Coakley, but there is that, by the end, there is the suggestion that maybe there is some sense that Coakley is working through her, you know, especially when it's the fact that he has to die for her to kind of, for the glamour to wear off, for her to switch, And it's when he expires that she stops being murderous.
I never got that. I didn't get that out of the episode, that it was him working through her.
Well, it could be, because at the very end, the moment she's about to stab Mulder and she's crazed, is the point when just you see Coakley expire, that kind of... And then suddenly she stops and she just collapses as if the shine has worn off.
Really? I never caught that on the... That was when... Because I thought it was weird that she didn't finish with the knife, right? But I never caught that he had died.
Yeah. He just goes... And then and then Scully says he's dead afterwards. So it's that last breath, and it's gone. So it's that it is ambiguous. And you know, there's little things like the fact she keeps Mrs. Thibodeau alive. She could have killed Mrs. Thibodeau. Is that right, that BJ is fighting back against this sort of, you know, latent unconscious possession by Coakley, that she doesn't want to kill this innocent woman who's been traumatized enough? And also, he's her grandmother.
Right. So, see, I caught that she was fighting back on that, but I still assumed it was the genetic thing throughout. I never caught that there was a psychic link between her and old Coakley.
But this is the thing. It's not 100%. I don't know if I'm right there. It is ambiguous. Mm-hmm. It could be. It couldn't. It might not be. But the timing of it is very interesting at that final moment. That it happened. The moment she stopped is the moment he dies. There is more to it, potentially. So when she does that, it could be that that's Coakley sort of punishing her, blaming her, and this whole idea of blame, that, you know, he wants to kind of exact that.
But he wouldn't have known about her, right? So he would, in order for him to have worked through her, he would have had to have known about her, right?
But maybe that's where the genetic memory comes from, the genetic sort of link. Maybe it is a sort of psychic muscle memory sort of thing that... It's suggested when Scully wraps the case up at the end, she suggests that maybe it was the pregnancy and the sort of switch on of these genes is what maybe triggered this link.
And so that's how I interpret the episode, is it's because of the pregnancy, but then that's why this happened in the end, right? So I never thought that. I know that she had the, it wasn't, and it turned out to not be psychic abilities. It was a memory that was coming to the surface for her, so this pregnancy activated these killer genes in her.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, this is the thing. It could be a bit of both. It could be one or the other. I think the suggestion is that it's definitely the genes. You know, Scully talks at the end about a mutated gene they've detected as well in BJ's code. Mm-hmm. But the idea is that I think there's a generational skip. You know, it's why at the end, it's good that she keeps the baby, because the reality is the baby's probably going to be okay because it skips a generation. Her dad was a detective as well. She mentions that.
Yeah.
And he wasn't affected by this, but she is. Right. So it could be that her baby, who presumably she had, because she does talk about it, she wants to abort the baby. So hopefully she didn't in the, mm-hmm. you know, what we don't see afterwards. But the suggestion is that that's not going to happen, that the baby will be born. So the baby mm-hmm. would be okay. It's that person's baby. Who could, well, but you could do a sequel. It could be that person's baby then triggers the latent Coakley or BJ memory of, mm-hmm. I don't know, it's fascinating because it's not certain. You don't know.
Man, the X-Files is good.
And that's why I really like this episode as well, because it does open that up and it makes you wonder. And that's why, you know, when we're at the point where she's, you know, finding the bones underneath the house and she's then certain it's Coakley. You know, she's seen young Coakley, and this is where, you know, they get Coakley in. Tillman's questioning him. Coakley's going, I can't even get to the bathroom. What are you talking about? This kind of thing. He's not going to be him. But you get some really good context now and some good conversations between Mulder and Scully that kind of... Mulder makes the point, you know, he eats the sunflower seeds, and he makes the point that my dad ate those sunflower seeds.
Right.
So do I eat sunflower seeds because my dad ate them, or because I've chosen to eat them? And I saw my dad eating them and I thought, oh, I'll try those. I made the choice. Or was it in me anyway?
It's because they taste good. That's why you eat some.
Yeah. And that's really interesting, I think. And I this is where the point where, you know, they find out that the idea that Coakley might be the killer, or someone connected to Coakley might be the killer, his grandson, Mulder theorizes. And that's why they have to go to Mrs. Thibodeau, who was the one survivor. And that's this poor woman. I really feel for this woman. She's mm-hmm. such a victim, but a strong woman, because she survived. She mm-hmm. stayed in the same house where she got attacked and nearly killed and raped. That takes some strength, doesn't it?
Yeah, you bet.
And she had a long marriage, but she didn't. She gave the baby up, that Coakley, mm-hmm. Because it was too evil a memory. She describes him in very sort of biblical terms as evil, Which is interesting because the other suggestion is that Coakley did what he did because he was a traumatized young boy.
And that's what comes back to the line that he says, someone's got to take the blame, little sister, it's not going to be me, right? So
yeah.
he's working something out from his father abusing him, and that's the line. It's like, so that's, I picture that that's something that his father said to him, right? Someone's got to take the blame as his father was beating him, right?
Yeah, and because he grew up with girls, he grew up with like a bunch of sisters, and he was, as Mrs. Thibodeau says, she found out when they were going through it years ago, that he was blamed for everything that went wrong by his father. His father exacted it all upon him, and that's what made his hatred for women so powerful. And, you know, the only reason that he killed a man, by the look of it, is because...
They were onto him.
They were onto him. Chaney and his partner were onto him, so he had to kill a guy, and he carved brother. But it is normally sister, and that's...
Right.
It is a hatred of women born out of that. So there's a very...
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Childhood-based psychology for Coakley. But it comes back to the nature versus nurture question. I mean, where do you stand on that, Brendan? Do you believe, because she talks about evil. Do you believe that he's evil or that he's made the way he is by his childhood circumstance?
I believe in both nature and nurture, right? And there's different instances. So, for example, in this one here, the reason why Coakley became a killer is because of the nurture, right, that
right.
he went through, right? Because of the way that his father treated him and stuff like this and the situations there. Now, with nature, there are certain things that I believe as well. Like, for example, with Mulder talking about the sunflower seeds. So that reminds me, I remember once when I was a teenager, and my aunt came to me. I was watching TV. I was laying on the floor with my hands crossed. I was on my belly with my hands crossed, laying, looking up at the TV. And my aunt said to me, your dad used to watch TV exactly like that. Now, I didn't live with my dad. My dad and I don't ever have any memories of living with my dad. I know who my dad is, and I've spent time with him, but I've never lived with him. He's never raised me. And there are times when I'm talking, you know, I'm talking to friends or I'm talking to my wife or whatever, and when I go to make a point on something, I make a specific hand motion that my dad makes. And there's no way I could have learned that because I've never spent enough time with my dad to have that kind of effect on me. But it's with my right hand, and I put my hand at my fingers at a 90-degree angle, and I use that to emphasize. I push my hand down like I'm hammering with a hammer, right? But I push my hand down with this 90-degree on my hand, and my dad does that. How do I do that? My dad didn't raise me, but whenever I do that, as soon as I make that motion, I think of my dad. And there's times when I enunciate words in a certain way, and I'm like, that's my dad. But I never lived with my dad, right?
Hmm.
So I really strongly believe in both, and I think that there's an aspect of both here. I do believe that the nature of things is strong, but nurture has an effect as well.
That's really fascinating, that is. And that's where the idea of genetic memory comes in, doesn't it? Because, you know, in your instance... I mean, obviously, the genetic memory idea in this episode is taken to slightly to the nth degree with murder and all this stuff. But the underlying principle is that BJ is acting... If the interpretation... If there isn't a psychic thing, and that suggestion at the end is just like a bit of a typical X-Files, oh, maybe it's this. If the actual reason is that it's genetic memory and she is... The genes inside her have triggered that latent murderous response in Coakley, then is it that... That is part of who she is in her DNA. But then equally, my question to that would be in terms of this episode, why does she then talk like Coakley? Why does she act like Coakley? Why does she...
Well, like I just said, why do I talk like my dad, right? I'm just saying, when I make a point, I'm making a point and I use inflection and tone just the way that my dad does. So that's why I think this episode is more about nature versus nurture rather than psychic connection. And that's what I think that the storyline was trying to get across. They're taking that idea of nature versus nurture and extrapolating it to, well, could you be predisposed to murder because of nature? So that's what I think the episode's about, right?
And well, yeah, and I think you're on the whole. I think you're right, and that's kind of what Mulder eventually, when they eventually get the information that BJ is Thibodeau's granddaughter, and Mulder finally clicks when they're thinking about Coakley's grandson and there being a younger person involved. When it finally clicks, BJ must be the killer. Scully can't quite track with Mulder's idea that BJ has transformed into Coakley because of this genetic memory. But I suppose what I'm getting at, really, is the question of whether or not there is an element of unconscious control and that, okay, BJ has Coakley's... If BJ has Coakley's natural genetic traits, then to me, would that mean that she's predisposed to either a certain, you know, the way she walks, the way she talks... You know, the way she, you know, she could have certain murderous impulses if those are in Coakley anyway. However, how do we get to the point where she's actively repeating phrases he's used, doing the same actions that he did when it's not her in control? And that's, I suppose, where I'm coming from, that where I wonder if there's another aspect to it.
I think that she is kind of in control, right? And it's just these genes that she can't control is what the story is trying to say. So... I don't know. To me, it's like she is in control when this is happening.
That's fascinating because then, like I say, that final moment where Coakley expires. No, I'm sorry to keep laboring this point.
That's what's great about the podcast. It's like we're getting so much out of it. And it's like, well, there's all these elements of the X-Files because you're originally brought into the file because of the psychic connection that Mulder's investigating, right? And then in the great X-Files tradition, it goes to this scientific explanation, and they've taken the kernel of an idea that's been debated for time and time again of nature versus nurture and extrapolated it to the nth degree with murder. And that's what the X-Files does fantastically, and that's why I love this episode so much, is it takes this idea and extrapolates, well, we understand this and people believe this, but what about this? Could it go this far?
Absolutely, yeah, and that is the beauty of it, and that's why there's so much to unpick. But again, I go back to why did when Coakley die, BJ suddenly stop killing Mulder?
I'm gonna have to watch that scene again and check it out.
Yeah, so, why does she suddenly sort of come out of the daze and then drop the knife, and then Tillman just picks her up and she's just, you know, confused? It's to me the suggestion is, and like I say, I don't know if I'm right, but the suggestion is BJ sort of. Whatever was going on ended the moment he died. So whether or not that his death meant sort of the genes that have activated in her sort of, you know, lied more dormant again, I don't know. But again, that suggests to me a sort of latent unconscious psychic sort of link. And that's where the ambiguity is. And I think you're right in terms of what they're doing. But I think that last moment adds a level of, okay, what does that mean?
Yeah, and again, brings it back to that X-File of, like, the unexplained and the paranormal, right?
It just adds that into it, which I think is great, really. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's basically how, you know, BJ goes to kill Mrs. Thibodeau as if she's trying to finish, you know, the work that Coakley did, but then she ends up going to Coakley to try and... It's great, really, because he's not a sympathetic character. He's a murderer. He's unrepentant to an extent. Mm-hmm. He says, you know, I served my time, everything like that. I had pills. They made me better. But he says it in a sort of, yeah, no, they didn't. So him being killed, you know, there's not a sense of injustice at all, but it is that sense that it is BJ's final transformation into him, you know, and she exacts the sins upon him. And in the end, it's great that he's just a scared old man pleading, going, no, please, please, please. At the end, it's great, really, to see that, because you're like, you know how it feels. She says, doesn't she? She says, now you know what it's like to be on the other end of the knife, brother.
Yeah, yeah.
It's quite fitting, really. It's a good ending, and I loved as well when she attacks Mulder, when he comes in, that as he's wriggling away and saying, don't, BJ, he flashes into Chaney.
Yeah, see, that's one of the things that I'm not sure about. Like, every flashback she's had before has been kind of a mixture of a memory with the person that's being killed right now, right? Like she saw that woman in the pool. She saw her face. She's like, that's the face I saw. And while she's trying to kill Mulder, she's seeing this guy from 50 years ago, you know? So it's different. Like, I understand what they're trying to go for, like maybe because he's the FBI agent who's on to her, right? So that's the connection. But that's one of the things that I think is a bit weak for me, it didn't work for me.
Yeah, I see what you mean. I think they're trying to make that parallel between Mulder and Chaney being the FBI agent who has found out what's going on and is now trying to... Yeah, and the idea that Chaney didn't survive back in the day. Coakley managed to kill him, and Mulder's almost like... It's like the past repeating itself. There is that element in this episode about the past and everything happening again, that loop, you know, that sense that the children become the father, or in this case, you know, the grandfather or whatever. It's right. Fascinating. It's those ideas that not just genetic memory, but actual events can loop if you become that same person. And I thought that was great, really. But I see what you right. mean.
So yeah. It's that paranormal aspect that they were adding to it. And again, with what I got out of the end of the episode, it didn't fit for me.
It's all sort of wrapped up contextually with Scully's final wrap-up. You've got less of these. This is more of a season one sort of narrative trick where the episode would end with either a Mulder little case diary file or Scully typing away on the computer. But I think it sometimes can be a bit of a cheat, but it works fine for me because it actually explains how certain things, talking of the mutated gene, how the pregnancy might have catalyzed the transformation. The child will be male, interestingly enough, as well, because they know that. So could she be giving birth to another Coakley, or is she giving birth to another Detective Morrow, her dad, who was a good man? And the idea that BJ's on suicide watch, and it's very, very sad at the end that she's just sitting there stroking the belly and she's lost herself.
Before I forget here, sorry, you just said something again. I wanted to say it earlier and I forgot. But that's more of why it's a nature versus nurture episode, was because she was raised by a good cop. That's that's the nurture. And then she became this killer. That's the nature. So that's, again, more enforcing on the nature versus nurture of this episode.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It's true, and it's absolutely true. And it's all those little details that they pepper in the script,
Right. She became a cop because her dad was a good cop. That's all she ever wanted to be. She says that in the episode. It's all I ever wanted to be was a good cop like my dad. Right? Yeah. So that's more of the nature versus nurture and what they're really heavily doing in this episode.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And it's well written by, whoever got the final credit, whether it was Chris Carter going back and doing some polishing or Morgan and Wong, or if it was Sara Chano, who did a really good job, I think, of layering a lot of different things in. She then goes on to write The Calasari. That's the only other episode she writes, which again is very much about family and very much about children and very much about the nurture and nature in a different way to do with evil. So she has kind of recurring themes. It's a good ending, and it we find out Tillman's going to adopt the baby, but BJ believes it will be evil. So it's left open-ended as to what happened, and I do wonder what happened to them afterwards. Whether that baby would now be 21 now, 20, 21.
Season 11, baby.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's get a sequel going.
Agent Scully, I gotta talk to you.
We're getting a statement.
You've accused BJ of murder?
Can we talk about this outside?
No, here, now!
Have you seen Detective Morrow?
No, I have not, but I don't care what you've accused her of. Detective Morrow could not hurt anybody.
Detective Morrow broke into this woman's house and attacked her with a razor.
Oh, come on, I do not believe that.
It's true. It happened.
Before you go, Brandon, you're not going to escape the joy, in inverted commas, of the X quiz, which you've been preparing for quite rigorously, haven't you?
What's this? My internet connection is failing. I can't quite hear you.
Nice try. Nice try. We have backups in place. Backup servers. You're not getting away that easy. So I've made the quiz slightly easier, and now we're just doing four questions and a quote. So five questions overall. So I've spared you a question that we have done in the past.
Oh, don't take it easy on me.
So are you ready for four questions and a quote, five questions on Aubrey?
Let's do it.
Okay. Question one. Sam Chaney was the investigative agent in the FBI in 1942 looking into the original murders in Aubrey. But what was the name of his partner?
Tim Ledbetter.
Well, you even got the first name. That's pretty good. Yeah. Tim Ledbetter. Well done. Excellent. Off the grid. Question two. When she's talking to Mulder and Scully about her visions and her dreams, BJ draws a symbol of the New York World's Fair. But what year was that fair represented? 1939. Well done. You really have done your homework. That's pretty impressive. I've got a real vibe. You might get five out of this. I think you're going to get top marks, Brandon. Here, I've got good vibes. Okay. Question three. How old was George Foreman when he won the heavyweight title, which Mulder mentions?
45.
Okay. Well done. Full mark so far. Okay, question four. Just before his attack by BJ, Coakley is watching an old film starring Cary Grant on the TV. Can you name that film?
His Girl Friday.
His Girl Friday. Amazing. Well done. You got just no sort of, no pause, no stopping to think. You just know.
I prepared. I'm like... I texted you this morning. I'm like, I'm basically writing out the teleplay for this episode in preparation for the X quiz.
It's pretty good. Okay, finally, question five. This is the quote. So if you can name the character and the scene, that'd be good. Okay. I don't think BJ was in the woods that night because of engine failure.
Dana Scully, when they were talking in, she was talking to Mulder in the, not the autopsy room, but when they were looking at the bones and at the computer.
Yep. Way! 5 out of 5. Top marks. You now join an elite club, Brandon.
Yes.
With, I believe, only Andrew Brooker and Darren Mooney who have got 5 out of 5 so far. So, well done. You are in the elite club of top scores. Okay, so that's Aubrey for us. We're going to wrap that up here. And it just leaves me to say a huge thank you, Brandon, for coming on for the second time to go through this this really good episode of The X-Files.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be here. This is a lot of fun. It's sparking my interest in The X-Files again. It's been a while since I've watched them all. So I'm planning on going through all the episodes. And like I was telling you this morning, I've gone through, I'm in early season one of your podcast. So I'm going to go back. I'm going to watch them as I listen to the episodes. And I'm going to follow along with you.
That is great, Brandon. That's brilliant. Thank you so much. And you're going to be back. You're going to be back, hopefully, for season three. We're going to get you back talking some more X-Files then. So
yeah, you bet.
Yeah, absolutely. We've got a little bit of a plan, haven't we, as well, to play the X-Files game and possibly...
Maybe. We'll see if we can make it work as a special episode.
See if we can do that, actually, yeah. So we've got that cooking. We'll see what we... Yeah, we'll see where we go with that. So yeah, it's been great to have you on. Where can people find you then to find out more about Melodic Treks, your podcast, and anything else you do?
So yeah, if you go to trek.fm, which is a website, we have lots and lots of Star Trek podcasts. My main show that I work on is called Melodic Treks, which is all about the music of Star Trek. And I do a lot of interviews and a lot of episode analysis on there. We have a daily rewatch that's been going on this year called From There to Here, where we watch 2 episodes of Star Trek a day every day. And I've been on, by the end of the year, I'll have been on a full third of those. So I participate a lot in that. And I've been a lot on our show called Warp 5, which is all about Enterprise. So you can find me lots on the network there. You can find me on Facebook if you want to reach out to me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter, at Brandon Metella is my Twitter page. And yeah, so those are the best places to find me.
Awesome. Just check out what Brandon does. It's great stuff. It's really interesting. The Trek podcasts are brilliant, as I've discussed before. So yeah, go and check out what he's up to, because it's great. We can be found on Twitter at @X_cast. Come on, join us, talk about the X-Files, follow us for what we're doing. We've got a Facebook page. If you just type in the X-Cast, we've got a Facebook group, the X-Cast podcast fan group. So check us out on there. We've got a growing community, lots of X-Files chatter. We've also got the X-Cast blog on WordPress, which has got all kinds of articles going up and reviews and of different X-Files media. So look that up as well. And we're on iTunes. So if you type in the X-Cast from whatever store you're in on iTunes, and do leave us a rating and a review, that'd be great if you can spare the time. It's pretty quick and easy on iTunes, and it would help us hugely. So that'd be brilliant. We've also got an email address, thexfcast@gmail.com. If you want to just let us know what you think about the show or any recommendations, or just drop us some email. And if we get some, we'll read it out on the podcast. So yeah, thanks a lot. Until next time, until we return, always remember, trust no one. The X-Cast is produced and presented by Tony Black, part of the Black Hole Media podcast network. Title music is courtesy of Will A, who you can find on Twitter @IAmWillAYE.